If all went according to Hoyle, the dispatch would be in the mail carrier's flivver and on its way to subscribers on the RFD routes by early Saturday morning. Charlie himself would fill the newspaper racks around the square in time to catch the Friday night moviegoers and Saturday shoppers. If there were any. Shoppers, that is. Business was picking up thanks to the Darling Dollars script that Alvin Duffy, the new bank president, had persuaded people to accept, as well as the boost the merchants were getting from the CCC camp. But Charlie was convinced that the town would never again be anything like as prosperous as it had been before the crash, which left the dispatch in a big round hole. He ground out his cigarette in the overflowing glass ashtray that sat on his father's 1909 Webster's New International Dictionary, opened the bottom drawer, and pulled out a bottle of warm Heyer's root beer. He missed the powerful kick he used to get from Mickey Ledoux's tiger spit, but he had promised Fanny to stop drinking the hard stuff, and he meant to keep that promise even if it killed him, which it very nearly did in the wee small hours of Friday morning, when he was finishing up the print run and before he married Fanny would have happily fallen into a jug of shine. These days, though, he went home to fall into bed beside his wife and sleep the sleep of the righteously sober next to her warm, soft, fragrant body, more than a fair trade for a day-long hangover. Except that this week he wouldn't be falling into bed beside Fanny for the simple reason that she wasn't there, which was partly responsible for Charlie's gloom. Miss Champagne, to Charlie's chagrin, his wife continued to use her professional name, was the proprietor of Champagne's Darling Chapeau, located on the west side of the courthouse square. She was also a professional milliner of some repute who had just completed 30-some ladies' hats, her fall line, as she called it. Charlie had helped her box them up and haul them to the L&N Depot to see them on their way to New York. Fanny herself had left yesterday for her meeting there with Lily Daché, a celebrated French milliner who provided custom-made hats for the Hollywood studios. Through Mademoiselle Daché, one of Fanny's chapeaux had ended up in Grand Hotel, on the handsome head of leading lady Joan Crawford. Miss Crawford had been quoted in the Hollywood Reporter as saying that she just adored that clever little hat. Voila! Fanny was famous, and her hats were now in great demand. Unfortunately, Fanny's celebrity came at a price, which was why she was in New York and Charlie was sleeping alone. His wife had rented an expensive suite in the Biltmore Hotel where she planned to display her fall line so all the big hat buyers in the city could come and take a look. If they liked something they saw, they would pay Fanny for the design, and her hat would be copied and sold to swanky department stores like Macy's in New York and Wanamaker's in Philly. Now that Roosevelt was making it possible for more people to have a few dollars more in their pockets, ladies' hats were big business again. And Fanny was not just a creative designer of exquisite ladies' hats. She was a businesswoman, and a damn successful one at that. Charlie didn't know how much she was making exactly. He just knew it had to be a lot. But while Miss Champagne might be a rising star in the millinery world, she was still Mrs. Charlie Dickens. And while Mr. Charlie Dickens certainly didn't object to his wife's career, he had been all for women getting the vote, hadn't he? He had expected that once they got married, she would give up junketing all over God's green earth and settle down to her darling hat shop downstairs from their apartment and catty-corner across the courthouse square from his newspaper office. As far as Charlie was concerned, this was an ideal situation. Fanny had paid cash for the building so they didn't have to pay a cent of rent. And she liked to cook and do other housewifely things, which made her husband's life exceedingly pleasant. After several years of living alone in the two upstairs rooms he rented from Mrs. Beadle, $5 a week, clean sheets but no housekeeping, meals, or laundry, Charlie was at last, you might say, in clover. Which was one reason why batching it bothered him so much, even if it was for just a couple of weeks. But as Charlie's dad used to say, A mule could be sweet as apple pie at one end and kick you crazy at the other, and something much more disturbing than Fanny's absence had gotten under Charlie's skin. He dearly loved his wife, but she had an independent streak a mile wide and 2 miles deep. She had kept her account book herself before they were married, and she insisted on doing that now. She refused to allow him to look it over, a fact that gnawed at Charlie no end. Now that they were married and would be required to file a joint income tax return for 1934, he thought he ought to at least have some idea of how much his other half was making and how well she was managing her money. Her money? Well, that was up for discussion, he thought. Now that they were married, wasn't it their money? So when he came back from putting Fanny on the Sunday morning train, Charlie made a momentous decision, one that was about to disorder his relatively well-ordered life. He sat down at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and Fanny's account books and made a discovery that shook him all the way down to the soles of his wingtip shoes. In the previous year, his wife's hat business had brought in some $2,400. Charlie stared at the number, scarcely believing his eyes. $2,400 was a small fortune, 50% more than the average Joe's salary and twice as much as last year's income from the newspaper. He gulped. He had no idea. Of course, he reminded himself, Fanny had to pay for her materials, advertising, and shipping, all of which were detailed in her precise hand in the expense columns. But those charges amounted to not much more than $400. She obviously kept her overhead costs low. Then his attention was caught by something else. A regular expense of $50 a month with no explanation. Just two letters. J.C. Charlie was baffled. $50 a month? $50 a month? Why, that totaled up to $600 a year, a quarter of what her entire business brought in. Was J.C. a person or what? Was Fanny repaying a debt? Was she making payments on a piece of property? If it was real estate, where was it? If it was a person, who was he or she? And even more importantly, why hadn't she told him? What was she hiding? Why was she hiding it? Didn't she trust him? And then he thought of something else. There had always been a bit of a mystery about Fanny, for she had simply gotten off the Greyhound bus one day, carried her suitcase across the courthouse square, and started making hats. Darling had been deeply curious about her because she was an unmarried woman, with no friends or family to welcome her to town, and no apparent reason to choose Darling over Mobile or Montgomery, or any other town for that matter. What's more, she made it abundantly clear that she was an independent woman who didn't need a man to support her or make her happy. And since Fanny was quite attractive, this fact alone was enough to make people take notice. Now, Darling loves nothing in the world so much as it loves gossip, so plenty of rumors had been floating around since Fanny's arrival. Out of the blue, people said, or really out of nowhere. Various informed sources had told Charlie that Miss Champagne had been engaged once, that she'd been married twice, that her fabulously wealthy husband had died, that her mobster husband had gone to prison for tax evasion, and she had divorced him, and that she had inherited a pot full of money from her father, who made an illicit fortune running guns from the Florida Keys to Cuba during the Spanish-American War. He had even heard that her mother was a rebellious heiress, possibly a Vanderbilt or maybe a Carnegie, who had given birth to Fanny out of wedlock and sent her to be raised by a couple in Atlanta. But whether this was fact or fiction had mattered not a whit to Charlie. He had been so besotted with love and so eager to marry this beautiful lady that that he had never once asked her who she really was and why she had come to Darling, and she had never volunteered the information. She was still a mystery, and up to now, it hadn't mattered. For all he cared, his wife could have killed somebody. Why, she might even be on the lam from the law. But regardless of who she was or what she had done, she was still Fanny. His Fanny. But now, confronted by this unexplained, inexplicable $600 annual expense, and given the empty pages in his wife's life history, Charlie found that he did care. He cared a very great deal, and his natural cynicism and reporter's instinct seized on the very worst possibility. This payment, was it, could it be, blackmail? What had Fanny done that she was paying for it so dearly? Baffled, Charlie had closed Fanny's account book with something like a sense of despair. And then he had gotten up from the table and done something he never imagined he would do. He wanted to find those canceled $50 checks, so he went into their bedroom and searched the closet, Fanny's dresser drawers, her stockings, her undies, her lacy chemises, her nightgowns, her shirtwaists, and the drawers in the nightstand next to her side of the bed. But there were no checks to be found, canceled or otherwise, which meant that she must be keeping them with all her other paperwork in the little office at the back of her hat shop. But Fanny had locked the shop up tight and must have taken the key with her, for it was nowhere to be found either. The only window was the front display window, and he couldn't get in that way. He considered breaking the lock, but that would be costly and, he had to admit, hard to explain. Charlie was in a quandary. He had thought he knew the only important things there were to know about his wife, that she was sweet, loving, patient, and generous to a fault. Witness her dealings with Rona Jean Hancock, the 11 o'clock lady, a few months before. Now, all he knew for sure was that Fanny was hiding a secret, and at this point, it really didn't much matter what the secret was or whether it was good or bad. The fact was that it was a secret. And, as his father used to say, there isn't a hell of a lot of difference between a hornet and a yellow jacket when he is raising Cain under your shirt. The regulator clock on the wall of the newspaper office cleared its throat, whirred, and began to strike 9. At her desk, Ophelia stopped typing and pushed back her chair and stood up. "Are you ready for me to put the local stories on the linotype?" she asked. "They're all there," Charlie said, pointing to the trays. He picked up his hires and took a swig. Of course, he could always just come straight out and ask Fanny where that $600 a year was going and why. But she would ask him how he knew about it, and he would have to confess he had looked at her accounts, which would probably make her so angry that she would... He couldn't begin to guess what she would do. But he knew that telling her would destroy the trust they had built up between them. Unfortunately, he didn't stop to ask himself whether his interest in, or perhaps more accurately, his obsession with, the way she spent her money signaled a lack of trust on his part. He just kept asking himself how he could discover who was getting Fanny $600 a year. He was an investigative reporter, wasn't he? He had dug up hundreds of bigger secrets than this one, hadn't he? He ought to be able to figure this one out. He was still trying to come up with ways to unravel this mystery when the telephone on his desk rang. He pulled it toward him and lifted the receiver from its cradle. "Dispatch office," he said curtly into the mouthpiece. "Dickens here." He listened for a few seconds, then transferred the earpiece to his left hand and picked up a pencil. "When did this happen?" he asked, and began jotting notes in the reporter's shorthand he'd used back when he was a real reporter and had real events to report. "Did you call the sheriff's office?" He jotted another line or two. "Do you know who?" But the call had been abruptly cut off, whether because the caller had said all there was to say or because the switchboard had dropped the connection, Charlie had no way of knowing. "Damn and blast," he muttered. Dropped connections happen too often these days. He should get Ophelia to dig into the problems at the exchange. It would be an easy story for her because she was friends with Myra May and Violet. They were all members of that garden club and could get them to tell her what was going on. But not now. He dropped the receiver in the cradle, grabbed his notebook and Rolleiflex camera, a relic of his real newspaper career when he carried it everywhere, and pushed his chair back. Ophelia! He shouted, reaching for his hat and his seersucker jacket. Something's come up. Go ahead and get started on the local pages, but we may cut something. There's going to be another story. And before she could ask him whether somebody's house was burning down or somebody had gone and got himself shot and killed, Charlie had shrugged into his jacket, jammed his fedora on his head, and was dashing out the door. It was just a few minutes past 9. Chapter 5. Liz Handles a Crisis. Business had been pretty slow in Mr. Mosley's law office lately, which gave Liz Lacey plenty of time to work on the garden column she wrote for the Dispatch. This week, she planned to write a piece on lucky plants in recognition of Darling's lucky four clovers. She had already gotten a good start on the column because she was using material from a talk that Miss Rogers had recently given at a meeting of the Dahlias. But today, Monday, had begun with a bang. A frantic 8:15 phone call from a panic-stricken lady whose voice Lizzie didn't immediately recognize. She had tried to get her to calm down and say who she was and why she was calling, but the woman just kept repeating frantically, "I've been trying and trying to get through, but there must be something wrong with the darn phone system. I have to talk to Mr. Mosley right now. Please, right this minute." And when Liz was finally able to make her understand that Mr. Mosley was out of town and wouldn't be back for a couple of days, the caller wailed, "But he promised I could call him any time, day or night." "If it's terribly urgent," Liz said, reluctantly, "I can give you the number for Mr. Jackman's office in Montgomery. That's where he's working." Mr. Mosley wouldn't like the interruption, but Liz thought the woman sounded so frantic that she should try to help. "Thank you," the woman said breathlessly. "I wouldn't ask, but I simply have to talk to him." Lizzie hung up, finished the last two bites of the cinnamon sugar donut she'd picked up at the diner on her way to work, and then got out the yellow legal pad that contained Mr. Mosley's notes on his private meeting with a client the previous week. Their discussion concerned a certain painful domestic matter, some of it quite sensational by Darling standards, anyway. It wasn't every day that the subject of divorce came up. It was Lizzie's job to type the notes, which she did quite rapidly, paying only enough attention to make sure she didn't make any mistakes. In the years she had worked for Mr. Mosley, she'd trained herself to mechanically reproduce his notes without recording the content in her brain. She did it by keeping her mind focused on another subject while her fingers transcribed Mr. Mosley's scrawls. Occupying her mind with something else made it easier for her to ignore the content of what she was typing, for, of course, she had to keep it confidential. Attorney-client privilege was one of Benton Mosley's most sacred principles, and since it was his, it had to be hers. This morning, Lizzie didn't have to search for something to distract her as she typed. Over the weekend, she had been confronted with a troubling personal dilemma that she couldn't get out of her mind. She typed mechanically as she thought about it, remembering. On Saturday morning, Lizzie had gone shopping at Hancock's Grocery, where she had been pleased to find a very nice pork roast for just 16 cents a pound and enough fresh apples for an apple pie, perfect for the company dinner she planned to cook that evening for Captain Gordon Campbell, commander of the CCC camp outside of town. She had also scooped up some bargains, 2 cans of Van Camp pork and beans for 6 cents a can, a crisp head of lettuce for a nickel, 3 pounds of sweet potatoes for 6 cents, and 1 pound of bacon for 1/4, all good buys. Old Zeke usually delivered groceries for Mrs. Hancock's customers, but he was laid up with a bad back, so that morning Lizzie had to carry. Toting her 2 heavy shopping bags, she was walking past Grady Alexander's house when, by accident or design, she never knew, but suspected the latter. Grady came out of his front door. He caught up with her quickly and took both bags out of her hands. It had been an awkward moment.
"Hello, Liz,"
Grady said quietly.
"It's good to see you. You're looking grand."
"Thank you," Lizzie avoided his searching glance. "It's nice to see you too, Grady." Fumbling for the right words, she said, "I've been meaning to drop you a note and tell you how sorry I am about your wife. It must be so hard for you." They began to walk again, Grady falling into step beside her.
"It is."
His voice was low and rough.
"I can't get used to it, Liz. I keep thinking it's just a bad dream. I'm going to wake up and find out that the last few months have never happened."
Not knowing how to answer, Lizzie slid him a quick sideways look, trying to see his face. Grady had never worn his brown hair slicked down the way other men did, and the breeze tossed it loosely across his forehead. He hadn't shaved that morning. His dark eyes were troubled, and he had long ago ceased to flash the rakish, devil-may-care grin that had once lit his serious face. She looked away quickly and shoved her hands in her jacket pockets. This was the man whom she had once expected to marry. After all, that was every darling girl's dream, wasn't it? Like all the other girls she knew, Lizzie had grown up thinking she would find a husband, have his children, keep his house neat as a pin, and live happily ever after. And why not Grady? He was tall and robust, good-looking, intelligent, and, she had thought, dependable. What's more, as Lizzie's mother repeatedly pointed out, he had a college degree and a steady job as the Cypress County agriculture agent. He would make a first-rate husband. "You cannot object to him in any conceivable way," her mother had said, truly annoyed with her daughter. "You should catch him while you can, Elizabeth. You won't be young forever, you know. Why, you're almost an old maid already." If truth be told, Lizzie very likely would have married Grady just to get away from her mother, a domineering woman who thought it was her job to manage her daughter's life. But then the old man who lived across the street had died, and Lizzie had bought his house and renovated it just the way she wanted it. It was too close to her mother, but except for that small flaw, it was a beautiful little house, so tiny that it almost looked like a dollhouse. It was just right for a single woman and her orange tabby cat, but too small for a daughter and her mother, and much too small for a married couple and their children. Lizzie loved her house, but even more she loved living there alone, because living alone gave her the solitude she needed to write. Growing up, she had written stories and poems, and she had long dreamed of writing a novel. But somewhere along the way, she had come to understand that taking care of a husband and children would mean that she'd have to give up her writing, temporarily, anyway, while the children were young, but maybe forever. When Grady proposed again, she had to say she just wasn't ready. They had gone along in that way for several years. Comfortable years, Lizzie had thought. And then, kaboom, Grady had dropped a bombshell. A year ago last spring, he had told her that he was marrying Archie Mann's pretty young niece, Sandra, that he had to marry her because she was expecting his baby. At first, Lizzie felt as helpless and disoriented as if she'd been whirled off her feet and flung through the air by a tornado that came roaring at her out of the dark. Pregnant? She'd had no idea that Grady was even seeing someone else. How could this have happened when the two of them had been so close for so long? But when she could think more calmly, Lizzie reflected that maybe it wasn't so surprising after all. She and Grady mostly saw things alike, but they had their differences, especially when it came to sex. He seemed to think that because they had been going out together for such a long time, he should be able to, that she should want to, that they should, well, go all the way. Now, Lizzie was by no means a prude, and she certainly enjoyed parking with Grady in his old blue Ford on the hill above the country club golf course, where they could watch the moon rise and the stars fall on Alabama, to borrow the title of a popular Guy Lombardo song. She enjoyed kissing Grady, and she loved the feeling of his hands all over her, and she loved him as well. She must, or she wouldn't let him touch her that way, would she? But if Grady didn't have a built-in sense of limits, Lizzie did. Inside her, somewhere, there was a warning sensor that flickered when enough was about to become too much. She made him stop the minute she knew that if she didn't make him stop now, she might stop wanting him to stop, which could be very dangerous. And it wasn't just because she was afraid she might get pregnant, although that was part of it, of course. She knew that if she and Grady had sex, he would jump to the natural conclusion that she was ready to marry him, and that would be wrong, for she wasn't. Not yet, anyway. But Sandra, who was barely out of her teens, hadn't known how to make him stop, or maybe she hadn't wanted to. It didn't much matter whether Grady had insisted or Sandra had invited, however, for in the end it was all the same. Actions, especially that one, definitely have consequences. Sandra got pregnant, and Grady, who was an honorable man, did the honorable thing. Right or wrong, like it or not, marriage was what Darling expected in a case like this, and the sooner the better. Grady married the girl. Poor Lizzie might have felt betrayed and terribly angry, and it says something about her character that she didn't. Oh, at first she did, of course. For days she was numb to everything but her own terrible pain. But it wasn't long before she realized that she was more sorry than angry. She was sorry for herself, but she was sorrier for Grady. And for Sandra, too. For Grady, because he'd had to do what duty obliged him to do. He had married Sandra, and he would take care of her and their baby. But Lizzie knew that somewhere deep down inside the dutiful husband and father, there would be a doomed dark center, like a fiery cinder grown cold and hard. Grady would become resigned, and yes, resentful. And she felt sorry for Sandra, because no matter how much she loved her husband, if Grady resented her, she would soon hate him, and perhaps even his child. There would be no escape for either. Still, Grady's marriage had come as an incredibly painful blow, and it took all of Lizzie's strength to pretend to her friends and her mother and Mr. Mosley that it didn't hurt. Darling thrived on gossip, and this little story of premarital lust and its consequences had tongues wagging all over Cypress County. The Dahlias were the only friends Lizzie could trust not to bring up the subject, and the garden was the only place she could get away from the gossip. To help her escape, Mr. Mosley had found her a temporary job with Mr. Jackman, a lawyer and friend in Montgomery. There, Lizzie had learned to live with her feelings and had put her spare time to use by writing a novel, a good one, too, even if it was her first. With the help of Mr. Jackman's wife and some remarkable good fortune, she had found a literary agent, Nadine Fleming, to represent her. Then, and even more remarkably, she thought, Miss Fleming had found a publisher for her book. Next week, she was scheduled to receive the galley pages of Sabrina, her historical novel about a wealthy, impetuous, and often imprudent young Alabama woman who lost her sweetheart at Gettysburg and was driven from her family plantation by marauding Yankee soldiers. "A rousing, romantic novel," Miss Fleming had said. "In an ordinary market, it should do quite well." "Sadly," she had added, "this isn't an ordinary market. The Depression has crippled the publishing industry, but of course we'll hope for the best." Now, Lizzie was back in her old life and on the job at Mr. Mosley's office. She had already started working on a second novel. It was proving to be more difficult than the first, but she felt that she was well on her way to becoming a writer, and a published writer at that. She likely wouldn't make much money, but that didn't matter, really. Just seeing her book in print was reward enough. But it was hard not to be painfully aware of Grady's new life as a married man, for he and Sandra had moved into the old Harrison place just down the block from Lizzie's house. She couldn't help noticing the attractive changes he was making in the old house. Paint and a new roof had made a big difference. And the flower garden Sandra planted. And Grady Jr.'s freshly washed diapers hanging on the backyard clothesline and his little wooden baby swing in the oak tree in the front yard. She supposed this was good, in a way, and even healing, for it required her to come to terms with the fact that Grady's life was moving on, just as hers was. She was more or less back on an even keel when something else happened. Something so inexpressibly dreadful that she could still scarcely bear to think of it. Late in the previous winter, the Darling Grapevine had reported that Grady's young wife was pregnant again. This news was met with a universally cheerful anticipation, for Sandra and Grady were legally married now, and all Darling celebrates every Darling baby with enthusiastic delight. And since there had been no baby showers for baby number one, couples who had to get married didn't get a shower. Darling made up for it with baby number two, which by the law of averages ought to be a girl. Sandra's sisters gave a shower, her aunt by marriage, Twyla Sue Mann, gave a shower, and the ladies at Sandra's church generously forgave her for her earlier moral lapse and gave a shower too. Of course, times were tough, and most of the gifts were hand-me-downs, with a little added lace and some embroidered bunnies. But it was the thought that mattered. Sandra must have been delighted. As it turned out, though, Sandra wasn't carrying a baby. Tragically, what was growing inside her was an especially virulent cancer. First the Darling doctor, then the doctor in Monroeville, and then two more doctors in Mobile had said there was nothing they could do for her, and apparently they were right. In the middle of September, all Darling, including Lizzie, attended the funeral and went with Grady to bury his young wife in a pleasant corner of Darling Cemetery out on Schoolhouse Road. Everybody said she looked very pretty, laid out in her wedding dress with her hair beautifully done and Grady Jr.'s little wooden horse in her hand. All agreed that Cecil Prudhorn, who engraved all the Darling headstones, had done an outstanding job with her monument, pink marble with a little angel carved on one corner. They left flowers on her grave and went home. That had been a month ago. Now, on this Saturday morning, seeing the man she'd once loved for the first time since he became a widower, Lizzie was having a hard time finding the words to comfort him. For the truth was that it wasn't a bad dream. The past few months had happened, and there was nothing he could do to escape them. What could she say that would help? Finally, she settled for something she knew to be inadequate. "I know this must be terribly, terribly hard, Grady. Sandra was so young and pretty, and everybody is saying that she was a wonderful mother." This was true. For the Darling Grapevine, quick to accuse but also quick to forgive, had found much to admire in the way Grady Jr.'s young mother had doted on her little boy. She added, "You must miss her, and little Grady, he must be bereft." Grady nodded. "He's staying with Sandra's mother right now over in Monroeville." He cleared his throat. "He's a pretty big handful for her, but I can't. Well, I'm working, you know, and I can't take care of him." He brightened. "I'm going to pick him up later this morning, though. I'll have him for the rest of the weekend. It's good for me. He's such a sweet little guy, and it gives his grandma a break." By this time, they had reached Lizzie's house, and she took the shopping bags out of his hands. "Thanks for carrying my groceries, Grady. I appreciate it." She hesitated, still fumbling for words. "I hope you and your little boy have a nice weekend." She turned to go.
"Wait, Liz."
Grady thrust his hands into his pockets.
"Hey, listen. I was wondering, would you..."
He took a breath.
"Would you like to have supper with Junior and me tonight? Nothing special, of course. The kid likes hot dogs and canned beans, so that's what we're having. We might even cook them over a fire in the backyard with marshmallows on a stick."
He grinned.
"For him, that's a big adventure."
Lizzie was nonplussed. How could he? Why, his wife had only been gone a few weeks. She herself had never been a person who paid much attention to what people might think, but this would be, well, unseemly. And anyway, she couldn't, even if she wanted to. She raised her eyes to his. I'm sorry, Grady. I have other plans. Because she spent her evenings and weekends writing, Lizzie didn't have much time for socializing. But she and Mr. Mosley went to the movies occasionally. The new editor of the newspaper in Monroeville had taken her out to dinner twice. And last week she had gone horseback riding with Captain Campbell. That had been fun. And she had reciprocated with an offer to cook dinner for him that night, which is why she had bought the pork roast and was planning an apple pie. Afterward, they were going to the Palace Theater to see Katharine Hepburn and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. in the new movie Morning Glory. But that wasn't the whole story, and she hurried to add to the rest. Even if I didn't, she said, I don't think it would be a very good idea. His lips thinned in the way she knew so well. I don't see why not, he said stubbornly. I think you do. She took a deep breath and said what had to be said. It's too soon, Grady. And then, since that still wasn't the real reason, she said, And anyway, we can't turn back the clock. What's done is done. We're not the way we were when we were together. We're different people now. He put his hand on her arm, his voice harsh, entreating. It doesn't have to be that way, Liz. I've never stopped loving you, in spite of Sandra and little Grady and all the rest of it. We can start over again. It will be better this time because we know what's important. We know, she said, pulling away from his hand and turning rapidly so he wouldn't see her tears. We can't. He gave her a searching look, and his voice grew even harder. You're not getting off so easily, Liz. This is important. I won't allow it. She had not known what to say to that, so she had simply turned and walked away. And even though she and Captain Campbell had spent a very nice Saturday evening together and made plans for another date, Lizzie couldn't forget the pain in Grady's voice or the undisguised pleading in his eyes. How truly terrible it must be for him, she thought, to lose his wife and be left with the care of his motherless little boy. By Sunday morning, her compassion had threatened to overrule her common sense, and it was all she could do not to reach for the telephone and invite Grady and little Grady to come over for Sunday lunch. She could make sandwiches out of the leftover pork roast, and they could eat outside at the picnic table, where anybody who walked past could see them and know that there wasn't any, well, hanky-panky. She had steeled herself against the impulse, but the thought of Grady had tugged at her heart all through Sunday. Now, on Monday morning, she was still thinking about Grady as she finished typing. She took Mr. Mosley's notes out of the typewriter, carried them into his office, and dropped them into the green In Progress folder in his desk drawer. She adjusted the Venetian blind at his window, brushed a fly off the windowsill, and then pulled open his closet door so she could see herself in the full-length mirror. Today, she was wearing one of her favorite work outfits, a slim-fitting gray wool and silk noil tweed skirt with kick pleats and a white silk crepe blouse with a pretty cowl neckline and the puff sleeves that were so popular. Together, a bargain for only $3.49 plus postage from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. When you had a Monday through Friday job and were trying to write a book on the weekends, you didn't have time to drive to Mobile or Montgomery to go shopping. She fluffed her loose brown hair, licked her little finger, and smoothed an eyebrow. She leaned forward, examining the wrinkles between her eyes, age wrinkles, surely, and frowned, thinking once again of Grady. What was she going to do? Then, with a sigh, she went back to her desk in the reception room. The Mosley Law Office, a longtime fixture in Darling, was located on the second floor of the dispatch building. If she worked late on a Thursday night, when Charlie Dickens was printing the Friday paper, the old Babcock press ran like a locomotive, rattling the windows and shaking the floors. But all was quiet now, and she took a deep breath and looked around. Besides her desk, the reception room had three chairs and a leather sofa for people who were waiting to see Mr. Mosley, as well as several floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. A stand in the corner held a dictionary that had once belonged to Jefferson Davis, open, at Mr. Mosley's instruction, to the word integrity. The floor was covered with a pair of worn oriental rugs, and the wood-paneled walls were hung with diplomas and maps and the gilt-framed oil portraits of the three senior Mr. Mosleys, Mr. Benton Mosley, who had inherited the law firm from his father, who had gotten it from his father and uncle, had a renegade streak, and refused to sit for his portrait. Yes, it was all very old-fashioned and staid and decorous, but it seemed to Lizzie to represent what people were seeking when they climbed the stairs. If not justice, then something close to it, something established, reliable, constant, and trustworthy. Something that would help them define the difference between what was right and what was wrong, and understand what consequences would follow from what they had done or failed to do. Even those who had broken the law had to respect what they found here. And if she needed another way to think about justice, she could look out the front windows and see the Cypress County Courthouse on the other side of the street. It was an imposing red brick building with a white-painted dome and a clock that told the right time, and a bell that rang so loud and clear that everybody in town could hear it and be comforted by it. Yes, Lizzie thought, justice was like that. It was solid, something you could count on to be the same way every day for everybody. Unlike life, which was completely unpredictable and unfair and full of unnerving surprises. Like Mr. Mosley remarking, too casually, that he might have to reduce her hours. Like Grady marrying Sandra out of the blue and Sandra unexpectedly dying and leaving behind a bewildered husband and a bereft little boy. That was life for you, and it had nothing to do with justice or people getting what they deserved. And now Grady seemed eager for them to be together again, and Lizzie felt the way she did when she and Myra May were girls and got on the Ferris wheel at the county fair, and a cable snapped, and the big wheel started going around faster and faster and faster, with all the riders screaming in terror and excitement. It had taken the entire Darling Volunteer Fire Department to stop them, and poor Al Barkley broke his arm when he tried to grab their gondola as they went whizzing past. Everybody said it was a wonder they hadn't gone spinning out into space. That was the way she felt now. There was no point denying that she had been in love with Grady once, or that she'd had to learn, hard lesson, not to love him, but without hating him or hating Sandra. And she hated the thought of hurting him now, but she could see where this was going, and what she saw both terrified and excited her at the very same time, just like that spinning Ferris wheel. She was still thinking about this when the telephone on her desk jangled. She picked it up and said, "Law office, good morning, how may I help you?" "It's long distance from Montgomery, Liz," an operator said, and Lizzie recognized Violet Sims' voice. It must be her turn on the switchboard. "Please hold while I connect you." There were several clicks, then several more, then, "Go ahead, please," and Mr. Mosley was on the line. "Liz," he said impatiently. "Liz, is that you? Are you there?"
"I'm here," Lizzie said. "What can I do for you?"
He sounded exasperated.
"I've been trying to get through for the last 10 minutes, but something must be the matter with Darling's phones. Anyway, I got a call here from Regina Whitworth. She sounded pretty frantic. Have you finished typing those notes?"
"I just got them done," Lizzie said. "They're in the green folder in your desk drawer."
"Good. Now here's what I want you to do." Mr. Mosley was being authoritative. "Close up the office and go over to the Whitworth's house. When you get there, talk to Mrs. Whitworth and find out as much as you can about what's going on, but don't upset her any more than she is already. Just get the facts.
Then telephone me at Jackman's office. Do it quick. Depending on what you find out, I may need to come back sooner than I planned.
What's happened? Lizzie asked. What's going on?
Danged if I know, Mr. Mosley replied impatiently. It's a crisis of some sort, so just go, will you?
As an afterthought, he added, If you run into the sheriff, see what you can find out from him, but don't let him in on whatever you learn from Mrs. Whitworth. Remember, client privilege.
He paused and added sternly,
Got that, Liz? Client privilege.
Got it, Lizzie said. I'm on my way.
She put down the phone, feeling her skin prickle. Obviously, some sort of crisis had happened. She put her notebook and pencil in her pocketbook and settled her dark blue, narrow-brimmed sailor hat on her head. Mr. Mosley was expecting her to investigate, and she wouldn't let him down. What's more, she would do her job so well that he would have to concede that she was indispensable. He would give up the idea of cutting her back to part-time.
Chapter 6 Myra May is stymied. At the Darling Diner, next door on the east to the dispatch office, Myra May Mosswell was cleaning up after the last breakfast customer had finished his coffee and gone out the door. Wearing a blue-bibbed apron over her red blouse and khaki slacks, she collected the empty mugs from the tables, dumped the coffee grounds out of the big urn, and began sweeping the floor behind the counter. From the kitchen, she could hear the comfortable chatter of Raylene and her helpers as they started lunch preparations. From the back room, she could hear the murmuring voices of Violet and Lenore Looper as they managed calls on the switchboard of the Darling Telephone Exchange, as well as Little Cupcake's sweet giggles as she played telephone with her dolls under Violet's chair. Myra May smiled to herself. Customer-wise, it had been a good morning. Now that the CCC camp was in full swing out by Briar Swamp, more money was coming into town. Myra May always measured the size of the crowd not just by the cash that ended up in the register, including the brightly colored Darling dollars, the emergency script still in circulation after the bank had nearly failed the year before, but by how much chow her customers put away. This morning, they had disposed of a large urn of coffee, 6 quarts of orange juice, 3 dozen eggs, 2.5 pounds of thick sliced bacon, 1/4 of a good sized smoked ham, 4 pounds of thin sliced red potatoes, 4-quart pot of grits, 3 dozen biscuits, and 5 quarts of Raylene's red eye gravy. The men, the diner's breakfast crowd was exclusively male, liked to eat. The men also liked to listen to the morning farm and market reports while they were downing all that chow, so the Philco on the shelf behind the counter was turned to Mobile's radio station, WALA. Supposedly, the letters stood for, We Are Loyal Alabamians. Myra May cared more about what she had to pay for pork chops at Hancock's Grocery than what pork bellies were selling for at the East St. Louis Stockyards, so she reached up and turned the dial to WGN, broadcasting from the Drake Hotel in Chicago. The 9 o'clock Music for Your Morning show had just begun, and the announcer was playing a recording of Bing Crosby crooning Dancing in the Dark. She turned up the volume and began to sing along. Smiling happily and swinging her broom in time with the music, she sang all the way to the last 2 lines of the chorus, We can face the music together, dancing in the dark. If somebody asked you who you thought was the prettiest woman in Darling, Myra May Mosswell would not top your list. She had a strong face with a square forehead, a square jaw, and deep-set eyes that seemed to bore straight through a person. If you had just met her, you might think she was checking to see if your hair was combed or your socks matched, but that wasn't it at all. She was checking to see if you had half a brain, and she stopped checking as soon as she figured out that you didn't. If there was one word to describe Myra May, direct would do it. If you wanted a few more words, you could try, does not suffer fools gladly. Myra May's best friend and partner, on the other hand, easily came to everyone's mind as the loveliest woman in Darling. Violet Sims was petite and picture pretty, with bouncy brown curls, a warm smile, and a soft heart. She and Myra May shared the diner, the exchange, the flat upstairs, and Little Cupcake. People who knew them explained their friendship as an illustration of the old saying, opposites attract. And since they were two very different people, perhaps that was true. But whatever held the two of them together made for a very strong bond. As far as business was concerned, Myra May's no-nonsense, let's-get-this-damn-job-done-now manner was complemented by Violet's sweet-natured charm and friendliness, which put everyone immediately at ease and made them want to pitch in and help. On the personal side, Violet's accommodating and sympathetic personality balanced Myra May's prickly impatience and smoothed out life's little bumps. Several years before, Myra May and Violet had purchased the diner and the Darling Telephone Exchange from old Mrs. Hooper, who had been forced to sell when her feet and ankles swelled so badly that she couldn't stand behind the counter. With the purchase had come a good-sized vegetable garden out back, a ramshackle garage for Bertha, Myra May's old green Chevy touring car, and a very nice upstairs flat with lots of windows and a pleasant view of the Cypress County Courthouse on the other side of Franklin Street. The flat was occupied by Myra May, Violet, and Violet's adorable 3-year-old niece, whom they had informally adopted after her mother's death. Cupcake had strawberry curls, dimples in both cheeks, and the bluest of blue eyes. She was the apple of her mama's eyes and the darling of Darling's fond heart. Darling swore that she was every bit as cute as Shirley Temple, whose latest movie, Bright Eyes, was a huge hit everywhere. The diner's kitchen was under the expert management of Raylene Riggs, Myra May's mother, who lived south of town at the Marigold Motor Court. The exchange was ably managed by Violet, with the help of a well-trained team of switchboard operators, the Hello Central Girls, as some darling wag had once called them. But nothing is ever perfect, and as it happened, there was an unfortunate fly in this otherwise delightful ointment. Myra May and Violet owned only half of the exchange. The other half, inconveniently, belonged to Mr. Whitney Whitworth, who was not an accommodating partner. When they first bought Mrs. Hooper's half of the exchange, Myra May and Violet had offered to buy his half, too, but they couldn't afford what he was asking. Now they could, but his price had gone up, way up, and out of their reach. Before, Mr. Whitney Whitworth had been an occasional pain in the patootie. Now he was a serious thorn in their side. The problem was that while their partner was glad to pocket half the profits, he did nothing to help with the management of the exchange. Worse, over the past 2 years, he had objected to every single one of the improvements Myra May and Violet proposed to make, and there were plenty of those since they were still using the original switchboard, which was over 20 years old. The Hello Central girls did the best they could, but calls had to wait, or were abruptly disconnected, or worse, switched to the wrong numbers. What's more, the party lines caused lots of problems, and people were demanding private lines, which they couldn't have because the old board didn't have enough capacity. Making the switchboard work, Violet said despairingly, was like trying to poke a cat out from under the porch with a rope. You just couldn't do the job with the only tool you had. The problem, unfortunately, was progress. When the exchange first started out back in 1913, most Darlinians got along just fine without a telephone. There were fewer calls, so one operator working part-time could easily handle the switchboard. But more and more people wanted telephones, and more telephone wire was strung on more and more poles around town. Violet now had to keep one or two and sometimes even three girls on duty. The poor things were packed shoulder to shoulder in front of the old switchboard like sardines in a can. On a warm, humid day in that small back room, they were hot enough to sizzle. Myra May kept abreast of the advances in telephone technology and felt that if they brought their equipment up to date, they could provide a much more reliable service. In fact, she was convinced that things were getting to the point where modernizing wasn't just an option. It had to be done. Or one morning, Darling would wake up and all the telephones in town would be dead as doorknobs. She had investigated and found a new exchange system with automatic features that would solve these problems. It would also allow Violet to reduce the number of Hello Central girls, and most attractively, it had a secret service feature that would keep the operators from listening in, which was always a problem in a small town. Sold by the Kellogg Switchboard Company in Chicago, the new equipment cost $1,000 down, with the rest on a monthly payment plan. $1,000 was a lot of money, of course, especially in these difficult days, but Myra May could come up with $500 from what was left of her father's small estate. If Mr. Whitworth would ante up the other half of the cost, they could get the job done quickly and make the monthly payments out of the savings. He wouldn't. "No, thank you," he had said pleasantly. "I see no need to improve our little enterprise, Miss Mosswell. It seems to be functioning quite adequately." "But you don't hear the complaints," Myra May had protested. "It is not functioning quite adequately. In fact, we're just damn lucky if it functions at all. What's more, if we replace the switchboard, we can reduce the number of operators. In the long run, we'll save enough money to pay for the thing twice over."
"No," Mr. Whitworth smiled a small smile. "Perhaps I should remind you once again, Miss Mosswell, that I am a limited partner." And that was the rub. Mrs. Hooper had signed a paper saying that the money she originally got from Mr. Whitworth to start the exchange was all she was ever going to get, while Mr. Whitworth would receive his share of the profits forever. He might be invited to invest more, but it was his privilege to say no, which he did. And it wasn't because he didn't have the money, Myra May thought resentfully. Mr. Whitworth's wife, Regina, had inherited a cotton plantation on the Alabama River from her grandmother, Helene Marie Vautier. The Whitworths lived in a nice brick home on Peachtree, a street of nice brick homes. Mr. Whitworth was a past member of the Darling Town Council, and he sang with the Lucky Four Clovers. He belonged to the Darling Rotary Club, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, and the Share the Wealth Society. He drove the 1923 Pierce Arrow that his wife had inherited from her grandmother, a fine old car that everyone in town had come to recognize. He was known to be a thrifty man who managed the family money carefully, a sterling citizen as far as Darling was concerned. But none of this was of any comfort to Myra May. She felt totally stymied by Mr. Whitworth's refusal to carry his fair share of their joint business responsibilities, regardless of his limited partnership. And in this unfortunate situation, she and Violet were not alone, for Mr. Whitworth was a limited partner in at least one other Darling business. She had heard that he treated his other partner in the same way, pocketing his share of the profits, if there were any, and refusing to put a dime into maintaining or expanding the business. Which is where matters stood on that October Monday. Things were, however, about to change, for just as Myra May finished sweeping and put her broom away, the front door opened, and Sheriff Buddy Norris came in, and from the grave look on his face, Myra May concluded that he hadn't come in for a nice hot breakfast and some friendly conversation. Something was going on in Darling, and the sheriff didn't like it. Chapter 7. The Dahlia's Bloom at the Beauty Bower. A few blocks away from the diner at the Beauty Bower on Dauphin Street, Beulah Trivette had just taken a stack of fluffy pink terry towels out of the laundry basket and put them into the cupboard. She was humming happily because it was Monday, and because Beulah considered herself to be the luckiest woman in Darling. With good reason, too, for Beulah Trivette had everything her heart desired. Her husband Hank, who might not be the handsomest guy in town, but was certainly the sweetest. And her smart son, Hank Jr., who had won Darling's grade school spelling bee last week with the word malfeasance, which Beulah had never once in her life even heard. And there was Hank Jr. standing up in front of everybody and spelling it pretty as you please. And her lovely blonde daughter, Spoony, and good friends, and the Beauty Bower, her very own hair salon.
The Beauty Bower was located in what had been a screened-in porch at the back of the Trivett house. Hank had enclosed the porch for her, installed two shampoo sinks, two hair-cutting stations, and big wall mirrors. He had also wired the place for electricity for hair dryers and the new electric permanent wave machine that Beulah mail-ordered from a firm in Minneapolis.